You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hypothetical.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff. This is the podcast that's all about the dolls. They were the groupies, the wives, the girlfriends, and the muses who played such a huge role in rock and roll history by simply being themselves.
They were sweet, sexy, brave, and powerful. They went after what and who they wanted, and they made no apologies.
We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx.
Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello, everybody, and happy Good Friday.
Good Friday to you all.
That voice that you hear there is my friend Kim. She's going to be joining us today, and we're going to be discussing, Kim, myself, Lynx, all together, are going to be discussing a book called The Sex Girl, a novel by Alice Carbone. Before we get into telling you who Alice is and getting into her novel, which is actually a first for us, we've done autobiographies, but not a novel, we're going to introduce our guest today, Kim.
Yes. So Kim is an art and music enthusiast, and she's visiting us from Montreal, but she's originally from Australia, which I'm sure you've gathered from the gorgeous accent she has. Oh. She's also co-host of the Badassery Show podcast, which is all about music and songwriting, and she has plans to open a fully equipped music and art gym in Montreal, which sounds amazing. Tell us about that.
Hello, ladies. It's so nice to be here with you both on this beautiful Good Friday. Super nice to be visiting Toronto as well. But yeah, I've been in Montreal for 5 years. Huge music fan. I like to play music myself. But yeah, my biggest passion personally is that I'm working towards opening a fully equipped art and music gym in Montreal, because moving halfway across the world, I didn't get to bring any stuff with me. And I'm just so strongly inclined every day to play music and do art. And I just think that there really should be a place for that.
I love this idea so much. I wish you lived in Toronto or doing it here.
I have friends here who are interested in doing it too. So hopefully, I mean, if we can do like a beta version in Montreal, it will reach other cities later. But I just think it's so necessary. And I'm baffled by the fact that this doesn't exist anywhere.
I know,
yet.
When you think about it, like,
how duh.
It?
Yeah,
it doesn't exist yet. So
it doesn't exist yet.
It's really innovative and completely different. And people might have heard the word gym and gone, what?
So some people don't get it. It's basically, gyms exist because it doesn't make sense for every man and his dog to go and buy every piece of gym equipment and put it in his apartment. Especially, this is the case in Montreal. It's one of the most densely populated cities in North America, actually. And it doesn't make sense. Like, you don't go and buy all the stuff. You go to your nearest gym and you buy a membership and you go there when you feel like it. It's the same thing with art and music. For some people, They get the same feeling and the same adrenaline and the same fulfillment from art and music as your, you know, your muscle men who love to go to the gym. It's just different preferences. But access to this stuff is so important because for some people, like, there's therapeutic reasons we don't even know about. We're just inclined to do this stuff. And I just think it really needs to exist. So
it's also a great way to find your instrument. Figure out,
go, like, play, what, yeah, like, be curious and pick things up and see what happens. And it's that open-mindedness that needs to be bred more these days, I think.
I love it.
That's, yay, wonderful. We'll have to keep everybody updated on the process and the I just want to let everybody know how Kim and I got hooked up. And I had received a message from our mutual friend Rael.
Shout outs, Rael.
Shout out to Rael.
What a babe.
And she said, oh my God, she's such a babe. Which, let me just give me a second. I specifically want to talk about, yes, that. Sent me a message and said, I need to introduce you to my friend Kim for two reasons. One, because she also has a podcast about music. And two, and maybe more importantly, she is the other biggest Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers fan I've ever met. And I was like, no, you're kidding. Because I've met men who are huge, huge, huge Tom Petty fans, but I've never met anybody who really shares what I share, the kind
of obsession.
And we're
like the same age. It's uncanny.
Yeah. And we came to like him differently, but like won't even get into that because we have an episode.
Exactly.
Where we talk. It's called Something About Tom Petty. And you can see it on YouTube. So you can go through the Badassery YouTube channel, mm-hmm, and watch us talking about it. It was the first time actually we had seen each other because it was a Skype.
I know. How funny is that?
Yeah, yeah.
It was so magical.
And then we were recorded it as well, so you can catch that on either or both if you want to listen to it two or three times.
You can find it in many ways.
Yeah, mm, on our sites. And it's funny because we kind of got hooked up, you know, blind date style. And do you know how I met Rael? We got hooked up blind date style.
Oh my God. Yes, actually, she did tell me that story like just the other day.
Yeah.
About you guys were going to the same festival and you were like, by the way, I'm just letting you know I'm going to be wearing a cape. And she was like, get out. I'm going to be wearing a cape too. And then you guys just found each other in the like crowd.
Yes, there was that. But we got hooked up by a mutual friend because I had told him that I wanted to like try starting to date women.
Okay.
Right? And he said, well, you know, I've got somebody who I think you're going to get along with really well. So I thought that we had gone out for a drink first and then, but maybe
possibly.
It could have been the other way around. No, it could be. Yeah, it could be first it was the cape thing and then we decided to meet for a drink.
Yeah, that seems logical to me knowing you both. That,
yeah,
you would have this like really cool thing and you had this precursor introduction and you both knew sort of and then it just played out.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So I don't know what it was that we just, it was friendship,
mm,
right after meeting. But I've always like had a big crush on Rael.
Yeah, she's a babe. She's a babe in so many different dimensions.
100%.
So... was it you who brought this book to Shanti?
Yes, that's what happened. So when I went, I fell into a, what would you call it? Just, I already knew about Tom Petty because my family loved the Traveling Wilburys. Growing up, it would always be playing this DVD, you know, when my family was drinking and stuff then. And this is just a very, very fast synopsis of the Petty show episode that we did. But I knew of them. Then last year, I found the documentary on Netflix, watched it. Basically every week for 6 months, realized I needed to go deep into their music catalog.
We watched it last night, yeah, together. It was like an actual dream come true. I asked myself, what did I do right in a past life to be here now,
dying,
with this beautiful angel watching my favorite rockumentary of all time? We, yeah, both knew it off by heart.
So we know every word. We were singing every song.
Like screaming at the same moments.
Oh,
and I'm like,
God,
this is groupie in 2017.
Yeah, and we were, yeah, you said before we had our phones and we were both like Instagramming at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. But I went deep into this Tom Petty phase last year. I listened to only the Tom Petty back catalog, 40 years of music, for like 6 months. I didn't listen to anything else. No radio, no nothing. And basically it led me on this like rabbit hole. It led me down a rabbit hole that was amazing. So I started like, okay, where are they now? And like, which ones have social media? And then I found, you know, Benmont. I was like, holy shit, Benmont has the craziest Instagram channel.
He really
hashtags
does.
Hashtags. Yeah. Just go find Ben Montench on and look at his hashtags and try
Instagram
not to die.
And Twitter.
He goes nuts. Like, I don't think he actually understands what they are, but it does not matter because he'll hashtag anything and everything, and it's hilarious. Anyway.
But he's so smart, and he's so kind, and he responds to people. He is somehow open, so responsive. Humble. Yeah, he's... it's really fantastic. So it's the same way that we found a couple of women was through these.
It's an ex. It's these like bands a thing of exploration.
So fascinated yeah. about.
If you go it, out and find the women behind the men, you'll find them. If you want to find them, you'll exactly. find them. They're always
we
there.
We find the music first, and then we find the men, and then the through the men we find the women,
and we all connect. And then I was saying to you guys before, this is just a theory, but I think those relationships feed back to the men, and then it feeds into the music, and it's just this like whole big
it's
feedback
a
loop.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I found Benmont. I found Alice, and I was interested in Alice because she's half Benmont's age. That's awesome, but I was like fascinated by her because that meant she was my age. And I just went, I found all these podcasts that she spoke on. I found out that she had a podcast, found out the book, read the book. And then as soon as I met you guys, I was like, oh my God, you need to get
and
this
so
book.
And so I had known about there. Her at this point, was yep. following her. Mm-hmm. And so if anybody, so Alice is originally from Italy. So she's Italian. She's beautiful. She has this beautiful Italian accent. And she's online and she's essentially healing through cooking. Because as we get into the synopsis of the book and we start to evaluate some of the characters, and it is a work of fiction, but there are some very autobiographical tones in it, which will...
She's openly said this is semi-autobiographical.
Yeah. It's... So she has an incredible story of addiction and recovery, and of course we're interested in and wanting to learn from these women who we go, I see myself in her, or I see myself in who she used to be, and how can I learn from this and receive this information and speak about it, share with other people the knowledge and information, and then actually hopefully speak to the woman herself about it.
Mm-hmm. If I could jump in and continue a little bit there. So Alice isn't just the wife of one of the most famous keyboardists in the world. She came to LA in, I guess it was like the mid-90s, early 2000s. She had a blog. She's in communications. She had a blog, and then she started a podcast, and she's obviously got her own affinity. Not obviously, she absolutely has her own affinity to music, because she had this podcast and she had Moby. Like, she just came from Europe to LA, didn't even know that many people. She had Moby, she had Benmont. That's how they met.
Incredible.
And, you know, she had all these famous musicians. Yeah, she had all these famous musicians on her show. And the titles, I don't know if you want to jump into that, Shanti, because it's a pretty special mention. Thing. The chapter titles.
Every
of the
chapter
book.
Title is of a song and a band, and a lot of the times I would go, oh, I love that
I'll
song.
Read the first.
I love that
all,
band.
All of the songs that she mentions are just so amazing.
Okay.
And Kim made a playlist, which we should probably add to our Spotify playlist as well.
Sure, yeah. I when reading the book, I listened to the music that went with each chapter.
Well.
Which is a really great way to do it. And kind of is almost an interactive piece.
Yeah, it really,
with the book.
It really
it's
adds
very
to
smart.
The
I was very impressed with that.
And I mean, she made a point to write these out, so I made a point to seek them out, you know?
Uh-huh.
That's true. Yeah, so I think she was doing a lot of the thing that I found so fascinating about this book was the amount of mystery. And then how much subsequent research we wanted to do, because we wanted to find out more. And it's funny because a theme of more is involved in this book too, especially in the
extremes.
World of addiction. And
yeah.
It's extremes. It's uh-huh. a book of absolute extremes. It's haunting. It's shocking. It's beautiful. It's poetic. And it's funny.
It's mysterious.
Yep.
Yeah. Siri keeps popping up in all my podcasts right now. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I just want to quickly, while we're talking about that, read some of the songs. So the first one, I found as many as I could on Spotify, added them to a playlist, and these are like mostly in order, but there's Changes by David Bowie. I'm skipping the ones that I don't know super well. Well, there's, okay, The Memory Remains, Metallica, Chloe Dancer / Crown of Thorns, Mother Love Bone, REM, Country Feedback, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Dig Lazarus, yeah. Dig. The Rolling Stones' Wild Horses, Shanti, is your favorite, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that was Canadian of me.
Oh, Oh, good for
Don't Fear the Reaper, Blue Oyster Cult, Placebo, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, Room at the Top, Leonard Cohen. I'm going to stop there and we'll carry on.
Okay, great. Do we want to get into the synopsis and then our fascination with the characters? Okay. Because and we're
drinking
gonna
my gin here, you guys.
Which we're gonna bring up. It's an important piece of information for everybody to know. It is pertinent that Kim is drinking gin and has Shanti
been.
Is
She's
not
getting into the mood. Has been getting into the mood for the last
3 hours. She's on holiday.
I'm on holiday.
Who? Which one wants to give the synopsis?
You go for it.
Oh, I definitely thought it was going to be you.
Are you prepared? Do you want me to do it? Do you want me to do it?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah.
This is funny.
Just
this is funny because
know, I could if I wanted to. I have a lot to say.
She has other stuff she's mentally preparing for.
Yeah.
Well, I read this the longest ago, but I feel like I'm compelled to do it. But Alice grew up in Turin in Italy. I think we're not really sure because it's semi-autobiographical. We're not really sure when she left Italy for real, but or even I don't even know when she left the book in left the country in the book. But she basically grew up in Italy, kind of dated musicians-ish. She was a little bit like rebellious. She already started to exhibit the things that, you know, haunted her more in her adulthood in LA as well, like some eating disorders, addiction to drugs and alcohol, and just, you know, this outlandish behavior, very things of extremes, but she talks a lot about the beautiful landscape and things like that. So it was very vividly explained to me. I remember that from reading it. She left LA to come to America. She studied communications and writing, very good writer, came to LA, very brave and bold of her, started a blog. The blog got huge. I think the blog got bought. She started a podcast.
We're talking about Alice.
Yes. And half of this stuff that I'm saying, which we're going to get into after, is things that really happened. But it's, yeah, this is what happened in the book. So I'm actually referring it to Alice, but it's Kay.
Yeah.
So I should have mentioned that. The character she talks about is Kay. She just refers to herself as Kay. But Shanti and I kind of seem to be on the same level about what's real and what's made up because it's semi-autobiographical.
And because we were so curious, we went and listened to podcasts that Alice actually spoke about. Things that happened in her life, which were very reminiscent of what happened in the book.
Mm-hmm. And some like stuff that we read online. So, but yeah, sorry, my bad. That's Kay, but most of it seems to have also happened to Alice. So going on with this Kay character, she doesn't have the podcast. This is what I mean. Like,
wait,
I know
no,
things
there's
that
no
are
podcast
real.
In the book.
Okay. So I'm half talking. I'm absolutely annihilating this synopsis.
Too much gin.
Too much gin. No, never.
Not enough gin.
Never enough gin. But
too much, baby.
Yeah. So Kay goes to LA, wants to kind of have a new start, but really struggles with the same things. Like, new scene doesn't necessarily mean like blank slate because you're still you, which really resonated with me personally, by the way. And she basically struggles through this like new life in LA. She meets this gentleman called Bill, which we're going to talk about in a minute, and just has this crazy life and really goes deep into some of her darkest moments, which resonated with me a lot. She struggles.
Yeah, her main struggles, or how she tries to deal with her struggles, is through drugs and bulimia, eating disorders.
I want to mention later as well that this is super something I've been it's something I've been thinking a lot about lately, because she's obviously got this deep pain, and where it comes from is kind of irrelevant because we all have pain from all different places, but nobody is taught how to deal with their pain. She's trying to drown it with drugs and alcohol and bulimia, and she's scratching at this itch, and now today the writer Alice is trying to actually deal with those things, and how hard must that be to deal with the pain without any of these tools anymore?
Exactly. And I think, kind of skipping ahead, I'm gonna address that right at the end, is the tools to dealing with the pain, which just from personal experience, I can speak to, because I'm almost finished my yoga teacher training. So just talking about like ethics of yoga philosophy and that lifestyle, and then just going back to Michael Dibar and his recovery and being sober for over 40 years and him being like a yogi as well, and finding some of those ethics in how to live your life and repair. Yes. But in terms of like, I think it's really interesting that you said nobody is ever taught to deal with their pain. I think because, well, I can say again, in working with young people, that actually in the mindfulness is coming in a lot sooner. So instead of having to do damage control, and instead of having to try to fix a really broken thing, it's prevention and it's tools. And I think that a lot of young people and their parents are wanting this sooner, acknowledging stresses, anxieties, and triggers sooner so that they can have very healthy ways to deal, to go close, to approach the pain, to acknowledge the hurt and work through it sooner instead of pushing until it gets out of control.
And to pick off where you said it doesn't matter where what the source of the pain is, that's a really good point, because even the character K doesn't seem to know exactly where it's from. And she does go to therapy. She is trying in the way that we're sort of taught, like talk about it. And she's trying to vocalize it. And her therapist is also trying to help. But sometimes you can't pinpoint what the issue is, which is also all the more devastating when you do want help.
Yes. That's a really good lead in to, I was like, how are we going to approach a work of fiction, a novel, instead of like an autobiography? Mm-hmm. Do you know
it's
what I mean?
Challenging.
So one thing that we did, like that I did, was I chose a couple of passages from the book that really resonated. And one of the things that she wrote was, "It is a mystery how Kay became such a tormented figure, given her apparently idyllic upbringing. Her parents were not rich, but she could honestly say that they always did their best to give her everything she needed, freedom included." So with a lot of our previous groupies, we can say, okay, Catherine James, horribly abused by her mother, right? But in terms of somebody like Kay, and as well as myself, idyllic upbringing, I would definitely use those words. And so when you think like, well, if somebody, because if you think about somebody who has serious addiction issues or mental health issues, you're like, okay, so what happened to them when they were a child to really get them going? But then we find out later that, I'm trying to remember if this is in the book or if this is Alice. I know it's definitely Alice, but I'm trying to remember if it was in the book. Links, you can let me know. Alice said that she had a grandmother who she loved. Again, a huge theme with a lot of the groupies. Myself, you know, a grandmother who really meant a lot to me. Actually, and a great aunt who became like a grandmother, who very much guided it and still guides me, even though she's passed on. Kay's Alice's grandmother. Oh my god.
It is both, right, Lynx?
I believe it's a huge theme
in the book.
Struggled with depression and tried to commit suicide. And then one thing that Kim and I had in common was, again, the upbringing, but then realizing later on in our lives the mental health issues as well as depression in our families. So on my dad's side, my great-grandfather committed suicide. It wasn't something that my family talked about very much when we were growing up, but it kind of came out once we had questions, which really affected my grandfather and which really affected the way he treated my father. And so realizing that my dad was struggling with mental health issues but keeping it very quiet so it wouldn't affect the family, but a very inner struggle. And then on my mom's side, huge alcoholism. My great-grandmother was an alcoholic, and all of my uncles were alcoholics, and all had to quit drinking at 50 or else all of their families were going to leave them. So for me, I'm like, okay, yes, wonderful upbringing, but then there's something in me that I was born with that can go to those places if under the wrong circumstances. So for me, I am not drinking alcohol at the moment. When I started this podcast, if you go back to episode one or two, the one with Mark, he says something like, okay, we'll have a beer after. Actually, no, like just tea, right? Because I wasn't drinking at the beginning of the podcast because I've gone through these spells in the last couple of years where I've been like, I'm done. I am so done. But then I'd be like, okay, I'm good now. I can have control. I can do it. And I tried to drink again. And then I have these moments where I'm in chains, like my life. I'm not free anymore. And that's what I want. That's what we all want. We want to be free. We want to accept. We want to all these things. And so I'm not drinking at the moment because by not drinking often, when I do decide, okay, I'll have one, and then one turns into three and three turns into nine, and then I display or I have behaviors that tap into both sides of myself that's in there from my genetics that makes me hate myself, which is the mania. So my mom, she's really cute. She calls it hyper, that everybody's hyper. Everybody on my mom's side of the family is hyper, but it's very manic and impulsive and yeah, like highs, very high highs and very low lows. And then thinking about the mental illness on my dad's side of the family. So for me personally, and I'm like, yeah, I'm recognizing that those parts of me come out. So I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to avoid that by avoiding alcohol and I'm fine.
I mean, I guess I'll jump in because, yeah, we had this little discussion before about it. I'm the same. I cannot fault my parents' upbringing with me and my brother and sister. They gave us everything we needed. We were never hungry. We never really had any problems. It was like uneventful. It was fine. It was great. I was probably, you know, always dreaming of something more. I was the kind of person who, like, I was put through a public school and I used to mix with these people who went to private school. So I was like, felt like I was missing out. But honestly, you know, in like super retrospect, my parents did a great job. There was nothing eventful. But as I was going into adolescence, I learned of all of this crazy trauma, which it's unrepeatable. Like in public, I can't tell the story online. I will probably share it with these girls later some other time, but it was stuff about my family's history on my mother's side that was very traumatic for her, makes her who she is today, and I'm really proud of who she is, and I am her, like 100% her in so many ways. It's scary, but this, you know, I learned all of this really uncomfortable, incredibly crazy stuff as I'm going into adolescence. And this wasn't affected with how I grew up. I mean, it involved family members that I knew and had, some of them had passed. So I thought I knew them. And then I'm told all of this stuff about them after they've passed, which changed everything. And my family also, for what you were speaking about as well, we all have very bad genetics for drinking. And you've tried to handle it the best way that you could. And for me, I'm a very all or nothing person and I see it as a fault sometimes. So for me, I'm not going to try to force myself to stop. I don't see it possible that I could stop drinking. I just have to be more cognizant of how I am. I have to check in with myself. I have to drink water because I can't not drink. I love drinking. I had to admit that to myself and that was very difficult. But I'm, yeah, this, so many things in this book resonated with me because I'm a person of extremes. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
I definitely relate to that too. It's interesting you talk about genetics. I definitely had an excessive drinking problem when I was younger, and it's funny because my father also did when he was young as well, and one day he woke up and was like, this isn't what I want, and he just quit. He was able to just quit just like that. And the craziest thing was I had that day where I had that awakening as well, and I was like, what am I doing? Like, this isn't, I'm not happy anymore. Like, this makes me hate myself, like you were saying. And I just quit. And it wasn't like a plan. I didn't expect it to happen. It just sort of happened one day. And I didn't decide, oh, I'm going to quit for this amount of time. It just,
like a short term thing. You were like, right, yeah, now it's not going
to
work.
I just need
for
to
me.
Take a little break. Mm. And then I was about a month. And I went out and just the smell of alcohol was so off-putting. Like, my whole body, like, could, like, revolted. And it was, like, it was 3 years before I could even, like, smell a drink again and be okay.
Were you working in the industry at that time, though? Was that hard?
Yeah. I was out, like, every night. And that's what kind of led up to the excessive drinking, too. When you go out, like, five nights a week and you're getting free alcohol from, like, everywhere you look. And I definitely didn't know how to say no. Mm.
I find with the going out and being a sober groupie, I like it because it's a challenge and it's a test that, like, if I want to be bold, then I need to be truthfully bold. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be just come from a place of true courage, mm-hmm. that I'm going to go up to this person or I'm going to say this thing, or maybe I want to be spontaneous, and it needs to come from a very natural place. So I was finding that the alcohol was like telling me lies. It was not true. Especially the next day when I would wake up and I would have these feelings, and have these feelings either towards myself or towards actions. And I probably would have done those same actions, you know, be it a text that I had sent or the way that I approached somebody.
But
I might
really
have done
interesting
that either
you,
way.
You challenge yourself to try it. You're like, okay, I did those things when I was drunk. Is it really what I want to do?
Right.
Should I try to do it? And it's nice, I think, that it's still sort of you, but it's a different you. And it's a more raw you and a real you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's also nice to remember.
Yeah, exactly. So, but like waking up the next day.
Amen to recollection.
Yeah. like waking up the next day and having those feelings of, oh my God, I'm so sad. It's like, that's false. I don't feel that way. And if I don't drink for 2 months, then I don't have those feelings. And then the minute that I do, I have them. So I know they're not real. It's like, and I don't want that. I want truth. Give me truth. And yeah, one of the best experiences I ever had was at a music festival in my hometown with somebody who was headlining the festival, and I wasn't drinking. And I remember every single thing, and we had a super sexy night, and I didn't drink. And he was like, well, I'm not gonna drink either then. So neither of us did.
It's nice. Awesome. It's good to have people around who support you. But I think as well, you have to be able to believe in a decision like that, even if the people around you don't support you. And I think there's probably so many people in this industry who have these like drunkards all around them all the time. And that's fine. Like, everybody's personal choice is fine. When it's bad, it's fine because it's a personal choice. When it's good, it's fine. It's always fine. But everybody has to be true to themselves. But I think it must be very hard for people to be true to themselves in this environment.
I agree. Would you like to talk about the character of Bill?
I would love to talk about that character. Wow. Okay, so we know from real life Alice Carbonet that she met Leonard Cohen. And
yeah, she did.
Yeah, she did.
She calls him Leonard.
Leonard. Oh. Like, I don't mean to say this in a jokey way, but like actually RIP because, wow.
Yes.
Like, let's... we'll take a moment for that. But she met him. She was totally moved by him. He saw in her a beautiful writer. He saw her spirit and her soul, I think. And his publishing house was related in the publishing of this book, which is amazing. And we know that she had this relationship with him. We know that she's married to Ben Montench. And it's so mysterious. Like, Bill Benmont. Is that character based on Benmont or is it based on Leonard? Did they have a relation? We don't know.
Or is it an amalgamation
yeah.
of both of them?
She seems very creative, so that could be possible.
I'm almost embarrassed that I didn't put the Leonard Cohen thing together myself. But when you said it, I went, oh my God.
You were
God.
Like, oh my God.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, cool. Or they could be somebody else, because you know what those two things tell us? She likes older men. Mm-hmm. And I think from the storyline of Kay, the character, because she's obviously been inspired by her own life, I think that Kay was also inspired by older men. Maybe the people that she dated, the musicians that she dated in Turin, in Italy, seemed like they were older than her. I don't know if that was the case. But she has this affinity with older men. And so maybe it was that one of those two. Maybe it was another guy. But this is one of the examples of the great mysteries of this book.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read a part of her book that she mentions Leonard Cohen. The character Kay mentions Leonard Cohen. She was taken with Leonard Cohen, not with the popular bands or with the hot soccer player of the national team. He was the ultimate poet. His humble handsomeness was irresistible.
Ooh. just like swoon there for a second.
She nailed it. Yeah, yeah, that's it. Like, I remember being in university and reading. That's how I came to Leonard Cohen. I did not listen to his music first. I read his poetry first. And I remember just being on the bus or sitting down by the Otonabee River and reading Leonard Cohen's poetry and just being just obsessed with it and the poet. And I was also taking, I graduated in English literature and French studies degree. So I was reading a lot of really awesome English lit, and a lot of it was a lot of the romantic stuff. And, you know, she mentions Lord Byron in her book. She's very romantic. She's very knowledgeable. She's very smart. What am I looking at?
I'm showing a photo that's got my Leonard Cohen, his latest record with my bra. Because it's black. It's black. Yeah. It was on my bedside table when I recently moved into a place by myself. I was feeling very alone. So I was like, I'm not alone if Leonard's with me.
Yeah.
So I put his record there, but usually it was leaning up against that lamp. And I took my bra off, which was also black, and I put it on the record and I took a photo and I was like, that's beautiful.
It is.
And sexy.
I was just
going to
say, very, very sexy photo.
I just wanted to bring that up.
Nice. Oh, I just saw in my notes there that that character K was writing an essay on Lord Byron. So, yeah, I can get that. So if you're like writing, if you're writing about these romantic poets, and oh, I would love to go back into my university notes and read what I wrote about them, or even just, you know, the summertime. I love reading poetry in the summertime. That'll probably be a
you
good time
check out
to.
Smith too.
Okay. Oh, I will. So remember we were talking about extremes. We were talking about being a person, like we are kind of all or nothing people. When we go for something, we go for it really hard. One thing that I found really interesting in both the book and both the podcast that I listened to about Alice was how she felt about Christmas. So she says in the book, I am waiting for Christmas. I always have high expectations for that day. So I thought about it and I went, oh my God, like I feel the same way. But then she was always like depressed afterwards. Like Christmas was like, she always had such high expectations.
Such a big buildup.
Such a big buildup. Always so excited. And then was so sad afterwards. And I experienced that as a child and I never understood why, but that's it. It's the buildup. It's the excitement. It's the wait,
the anticipation.
Then it's 25 minutes of pure bliss, opening up gifts, feeling a rush, feeling super high, and then looking at all of your things and then going, it's done.
Yeah.
It's over.
I feel like a lot of people get this way for New Year's Eve as well. It's like,
it's everything. And I experience the same thing. Birthdays, every event, like a friend's birthday party growing up, I had so many letdowns because of expectations. And as an adult, it was only recently, I'm turning 30 soon, where I realized having expectations is so damaging, and it's something that we don't realize that we do. But if you can be cognizant of it, you can save yourself
that
pain.
And that's it. That's something that we learn in yoga, is not being attached to the outcome and the result.
And meditation, they
but
teach
just
that.
Yeah, being equanimous, like regardless of what happens. But I was
gonna say, and you can link that back to addiction.
Yeah. So exactly, because it's always wanting more. It's getting the hit. It's feeling the rush and feeling the bliss. And then it leaving and asking, what now?
Yeah.
What more? And so it's never that I was disappointed with the gifts that I had gotten. In fact, I looked at the gifts. I was like, oh my God, I just got, even as like an 8-year-old, being like, I just got so many amazing things. And then crash an overwhelming sense of guilt of feeling sad over it either being over or just feeling empty and not knowing why. And I think it's because now we're seeing this very basic thing, even starting as a child, of the wait and the anticipation. And then it even made me think about how I was obsessed with this guy in university. I met him in 2009 and I was obsessed with him for a good 5 years. Yeah. And there was other boyfriends in and out of my life during those times. And he's the one that, when I was talking to Mickey, and I'm just like, how to let go? And what I'm realizing is because he lived out of town, and the moment he left, the calendar started. When does he get back?
The countdown.
Thank you so much.
The hardest. I'm here to drop into Tom Petty whenever it's necessary.
Exactly. Yes. So I would wait. I would wait. I would wait. Anticipation, anticipation, anticipation. Maybe 2 days, maybe 2 hours of what then of the bliss that I experienced after the anticipation, the absolute crash of when he left and the depression that happened, and then the calendar that started mm-hmm. again.
This is super related to the whole thing about anxiety and depression, because people who think too much about the future are anxious people. People who hold on too much to the past are depressed people. So there would have been a stage in what you just explained where you had depression and you had anxiety because you start the countdown, but there's so much time to go. So you're having this mix and back and forth of anxiety and depression and these little breaks of when the magic is happening. But it's just, it's very traumatic and we're not taught how to deal with that. People who go to self-help books are judged and there's a stigma to that. But like fucking honestly, that's how I recently learned how to deal with all this stuff. You have to learn how to deal with your pain. And yeah. for people like us with these extremes and this anticipation and waiting, we have to learn, which I learned like personally through meditation, is to sit with nothing, doing nothing and be like, you learn so much about yourself. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not waiting for something. I'm not thinking about something from the past. I'm just right here, right now. And it's fucking scary. It's very scary. Yeah.
Just being present.
And yeah, so many people are scared to just be them, you know?
It's terrifying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrifying to fake come up against yourself, you know, with no armor.
Yeah, so that's called, so one thing I'm learning, so our minds are our chit. And those little things that bother us and that come through are your vrittis. Mm-hmm. So chit vritti. And so when you're sitting there in meditation, you are watching your chit and then you watch the vrittis that come up and then you just allow them to move forward.
Let everything be.
That's it. So, you know, we've gotten really deep in this episode, probably the most personal we have gotten in this sense so far on the podcast, which is I'm so happy to have gone to have gone here. But the book is funny, too. So she's so self-aware and there are some really great moments where I giggled to myself. And one of them is I believe she's talking about Bill. And she says about him, his father had committed suicide when he was 15 and his older sister had already left the country and moved to India to find her true self with the Hare Krishna, then opened an orphanage with her second husband after 3 years of chanting, a rigorous vegetarian diet and extreme yoga practices. And I can't help but laugh about that because I'm always like, yoga this and yoga that. And I understand, like, for some people, like, they don't want to hear it. And they're like, oh, there she goes again with her, like, you know, because sometimes the most tortured people are like, peace, I'm going to India. And sometimes it's extreme, and we do have fake yogis out there, and we do have, I call them silicone yogis that are the, like, you know, they talk the talk, but yeah. they don't walk the yogi walk. I thought that was pretty funny that she added that in, because
it's a great way to be able to laugh about these things, because, you know, otherwise how else are you going to get through it?
Yeah, she's a really beautiful author.
Mm. I was blown away.
Yeah, it reads like poetry. It's very lyrical. It flows.
And it's vivid, I found. Yes. I'm an imaginative person, but I found it to be more vivid than other things I've read.
So I really like when she said a rigorous vegetarian diet, because, again, we talk about people with extremes, eating. Eating is one of the biggest ways that people can control something, have control over something, especially if they feel like their life is spiraling out of control.
Or lose control, yeah.
That moment, that's right. So, again, going back to the ideal upbringing, I grew up in a family with a completely loving and supportive father who did anything and everything for me. It was like, as you wish, or... yes, angel, whatever it is. Like, and then I had two brothers who valued me for my intelligence and my sense of humor. But like, I saw my little brother today and he looked at me and said, "You look great." You know? So he's like, they're not afraid to also comment on my looks and tell me, "You're looking really healthy. You're looking really good." Or, you know, or my older brother being like, "Oh, yeah, I can really tell that you've been working out," or whatever. Like, they're not afraid to say that. But
intelligent people,
they're so wonderful. But they always, like, it wasn't just that either. Do you know what I mean? But regardless of all of those things, being valued for being smart and getting good grades and being a hard worker and going after things that I wanted, I still felt this extreme pressure to look a certain way and to have my body be a certain way. So I remember from a very young age just asking, so how do calories work? How do I make sure that I'm not gaining? How much exercise do I need to do? You know, having no idea. Like, remember, you know, like being in university and working out all the time, but having a diet of absolute crap and just not really understanding how all of that stuff works.
Well, it's very traumatic. It's like friction in yourself. It's like...
You know, watching a best friend who had an eating disorder because her mother was always after her about losing weight, but really she just had like she had broad shoulders and like she was from Belgium, like just like a taller girl. So a part of it, and then just of course society and like those kind of standards and things like that. That I wouldn't necessarily say that I had an eating disorder until probably. When I was in Halifax. And
how old were you then?
27.
Okay.
Maybe 26. And nobody noticed, like nobody could really tell like that I was struggling through something or like counting things because I disguised it as healthy because I was following a really, really, really rigorous paleo diet, which is meat, vegetables, a little bit of fruit, and nuts, and there's no grains, there's no dairy, anything like that. So then I got almost like a phobia of like grains and dairy and things like that. And I was working out all the time because I had the time to do it. And I got down to probably just above 100 pounds. And I went home and my grandparents and my uncles complimented me. I got a lot of compliments on how I looked when I was really thin. And like I had, like my breasts were barely there. And I was so proud of myself that I like had such self-control. And I'd like go to restaurants or I'd be at like a dinner table with people. And I would only put like, I would have a full plate, but I would feel so good that I didn't take the piece of bread and put it on my plate, or that I didn't put the gravy on, or that I wasn't eating the potatoes because they weren't a part of the diet, right? The only person that mentioned anything about my weight was my best friend since I was 4. When she saw me, she was like, "What is up?"
Like the truthful one, the one that actually had that care
realization. Yeah. So I know we talked about this when you get down to this weight and all of a sudden you're getting these compliments. And I'm like, this is my true body. This is what it really should look like. And, you know, I remember my grandmother saying, "Oh, you look so skinny. You look like teenager." and my uncle being like, "You look so good." Yeah. And so like that compliment being like, "Yeah, I do. I thank you." Because somehow even my grandparents and my great uncle picked up this thing that like that's what girls should be looking like. I don't know where the hell they got that from, but
and then there's this point where you sort of start thinking, does that mean I looked bad before?
Yeah,
especially if you're an overthinker, you start to go down that road.
So so I had that going on, and it kind of all came to a head when I went traveling because I was like, well, I'm not going to eat a paleo diet when I'm in Nepal. And then I go to Ireland and I was in England and I just kind of ate what I wanted. And I instantly gained so much weight because my body is so sensitive. Yeah. If I eat a certain way, 2 weeks later, my body will look this way. And if I exercise a certain way, 2 weeks later, my body is going to look this way. So all of a sudden I was up 10 pounds on a frame that's like pretty small.
And you denied your body for so long of those things. So.
Yeah.
It's gonna take what it wants when you finally do give it to it.
So essentially I've been for the past year just trying to reboot and go, what do I need?
What feels right? I'm almost
30 years old. Like, I'm becoming like a woman. What should this body look like? How should it feel? More importantly. Yeah. So I'm just trying to eat. So that's why I love Alice's like healing through cooking, because she was there. Like, she was extreme bulimic, like so bad.
Very, very bad.
And you know, mine didn't get there, but I like the idea of healing through cooking and not having these like mega restrictions.
Because you have to redefine your relationship with food and your body It's and she is such a good role model for that. That's not something that so much relates to the book, but after that.
Talking about intuition and just listening to your body and finding out what's right for you. Diets don't work for everyone. Mm. You can't just look at something in a book and be like, yep, this is for me. You do have to experiment. You have to try new things. That's why cooking is so great. Like, pick what you like and see what works.
But like the paleo thing, like that's pretty scientific. If either of you were to go, okay, I'm going to do this paleo thing and I'm going to cut out all of these things and then going to pair that with like high intensity workout 3 days a week and maybe some yoga like during that as well, you would both be down 15 pounds.
Oh yeah. When I said diets don't work forever, yeah. I didn't mean like that you wouldn't lose weight. Right. Like it might not be healthy.
But what's
for your
life?
Body
what's your lifestyle? Exactly. What's your background? Exactly. What's your personality? Like, there's so many variables. Mm-hmm. I might like just quickly jump into mine, but I grew up with my main female role models struggling with their own things so much, and it was so visible to me. A lot of yo-yo dieting, and so that was what I knew to be normal. I didn't have healthy. I didn't have female role models in my life that had healthy relationships to food. My sister a little bit, my mum struggled a lot. And so me finding my way took a very long time. And I would say I had my worst experiences when I was in my late teens, early 20s, very traumatic. I was never diagnosed with an eating disorder, but I was borderline, like a lot of struggles. You know, I would take breakups the wrong way and think that my body was wrong. I would compare myself against magazines. Probably a lot of things that a lot of other girls do, but it was really in my I've always been very sporty. I'm very tall, so I'm lucky if my weight fluctuated a lot, which it did at sometimes. People couldn't really tell, but I knew. Mm-hmm. And I have to just say, it's not until I reached my late 20s where I finally started to feel what was right and listen to my intuition. Like, currently I'm happy with my body. I prefer to eat healthy because it feels good, and I do what exercise and movement feels right, and it's just so beautiful to have found that balance. But it takes time. So if any young girls are listening to this, like, don't beat yourself up, because it's fucking hard.
Absolutely. And I never had eating issues. I was actually a really chubby girl growing up. I feel very lucky that it never affected me mentally. I managed to get through that, and my weight naturally dropped as I grew up, just from activities and stuff.
Your lifestyle.
Yeah. Yes. But the interesting thing is, when I look back now, I was always comfortable with who I was, but even then, in the back of my head, it would be like, hey, I'm happy with my body and I'm happy with who I am. But if I were maybe a dress size or two smaller, then I would have like the perfect body. But this is all right. And like a decade later, I look at photos of me back then and I think, how the hell did I ever think that? Like, look at how skinny I was. Like, it's just so crazy, like, what your mind can do.
Yeah. And just that idea of skinny can be beautiful, but skinny does not equal beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's not the recipe for beautiful. Beauty is so much more, and beauty comes in all different sizes and shapes and colors and everything. Like, true beauty is inner anyways. So you can have the runway model who we've been taught and conditioned to believe number one beauty, but if they don't have the heart, and if they don't have the spirit, and they don't have
the intellect,
passion for making the world a better place than when they found it, then that's not anything to
me. And if they're not healthy, if it's not a natural thing for them to be thin, if there's you don't know what's going on,
you don't know what's under the surface.
Yeah.
So touching on extremes, this book is called The Sex Girl. And I think because of where we are for time, and as well as because the book is called The Sex Girl and we've already touched so much, I think we should leave it up to listeners to go and look at this book and pay attention to and read and be shocked and amazed and blown away by the way Alice talks about sex. And then they can kind of come to their own things, because, of course, we could now go on for another 20 minutes and talk about how we relate to the book and how we relate to the sex girl in our own lives. But I think we should just leave it up to the readers or the listeners.
It's an incredible book to read. Yeah. Oh, my God.
There's so many layers to it.
And it's just so interesting. I don't think that she knew what it would be when she was writing it, to be honest, because she's probably, well, we know that she took a lot of the content from her own diaries and her own experience, semi-autobiographical, but it's just come out as this like enigma kind of thing. Like, it's so fascinating and mysterious and like
complicated, but yeah, simple in a way.
I think that there's just so many things that girls like us, and even girls that aren't necessarily as into this scene, the music scene, as we are, any girl will relate to this book.
Absolutely.
In one way or another.
Relatable.
But then the music connection is incredible too. Mm. So the fact that she's so passionate about music, and then, you know, just relating it to the whole of all of the women and all of the groupies and all of the rock stars, and the connection between extremes and creativities and passions and substance abuse. Mm.
And there's one question that kept popping up into my head. She never mentions the song itself, but there's a band, I think the song came out in the 90s or early 2000s, by a band called K's Choice. Mm. And it's called Not an Addict. And it's about, you know, deceiving yourself on what you are, basically. Yeah. And I just found it interesting that the character's name is Kay, and this song kept popping into my head.
So, Alice, if you're listening to this, could you maybe send us a message and let us know? We're very curious.
Many questions.
Or you can just say that you'll come on and you'll tell us, you'll just tell us in your own words,
yes,
and answer our questions that we have for you, because we have lots more, and we just, now I'm just like speaking to you. We just love you so
much. Yeah,
when
you finish the book, like, you're not finished with the book. You
kind of
more.
End up with more questions than you started with.
Speaking of finishing the book, what, like, a hell of an ending.
Oh my God.
It's got this all
is,
of us.
This is the thing, right?
We're all avid book readers.
Yes.
And we did not.
None of us saw this coming. Also, we just want to say that when we talk about it being kind of fiction, semi-autobiographical, I believe, and Shanti and I have kind of agreed a bit on this before, I think it's like 95% based on Alice's life. And I think the 5% that's different is the ending. I think the rest of it, I think she's changed people's names slightly. I think she's used a bit of like smoke and mirrors, which I love because it hooked me so hard on this book. But I think the ending is the only different thing to her life.
Well,
personally.
Yeah, maybe we can ask her one day. Or maybe it's better to keep it a mystery.
We would love to know.
Yeah, we'd love to know. And if it's okay with you guys, I just want to go over the ethics of yoga, because I think that's how Alice is really living her life. I think that's really how Michael DeBar is living his life. And because these episodes have been back to back and it seems to be a theme, it might be just interesting to tell the listeners what they are and then kind of see how they can incorporate that into their own lives. So one thing that we, the three of us girls, and Alice as well, Michael as well, Pamela too, vegetarians.
Yeah.
We're all vegetarian. No. Pamela is a vegetarian, isn't she?
Is she? Maybe. I'm a vegetarian.
Me too. Pescatarian, but vegetarian sounds less pretentious.
So, and I've just started because of...
You're a vegetarian now?
Yeah, for almost a month.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So, and I really wanted to do this because I really want to live my life as ethically as possible. Like, I know now. I know better now. And I know, I feel like, or I'm getting the idea of what I'm doing here and how I want to continue living out the rest of my life. And a lot of it is based on these yoga ethics. Number one being ahimsa, which is nonviolence. The only reason why I hadn't gotten into vegetarianism before was because I was scared that I was going to gain weight. So I actually messaged Alice, or I commented on one of the things that she had written. I said, so you're a vegetarian, right? And I told her, I've been thinking about it, but I am worried. And she said, well, you know, anyway, she gave me a really, like, she replied back and it made me feel really good. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go forwards. Thank you. And I really hope she does. She's working on a cookbook and I, like, really can't wait I would pre-order it. Do you know what I mean? But I've let that go. Like, it's more important to me at this point to live this way ethically and just make a more of an effort to just not, like, eat bread for every single meal. But it's okay to eat bread again. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And then to be able to live a little bit more ethically, which I've chosen to do now. Because before the way I look took precedent over everything. And I'm done with that now. So the five yamas are ahimsa, which is do no harm. Satya, which is to be honest and truthful. Asteya, which is not stealing. That could be not stealing people's possessions. It could be not stealing people's time, anything like that. Brahmacharya, which is no sexual impropriety. So essentially what that means is that happiness doesn't lie in the sexual field. Although we get feelings of bliss and happiness from having sex. So that's why people can get addicted to that as well. But it's just caring about others and caring about yourself in the sexual manner. Right? Aparigraha, which is non-greediness, non-hoarding. So if you were to look in my room right now, I'm obviously so having timely. Some...
A bomb went off in Shanti's room.
But it's because I'm trying to get rid. And I passed on like I six pieces of clothing to Kim.
I coat I was like looking for in the stores. And I was like, God, I don't want to buy this coat. So this worked out so well for me.
Yeah, and it looks great on you. And some of the clothes that weren't really fitting me, great. Like they look amazing on you. So good. I'm glad. And I've got two bags to donate. And... So I'm trying. I'm cleansing, non-hoarding.
I actually have a box at home that I'm trying to donate as well.
Yeah. Good.
Should put our stuff together.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay. So that was the five. That was the five yamas. Now there's the five niyamas. And it's some things to do for yourself. So a lot of those ones were like, no, no, no. Every time there's aha, like ah is non. Okay. So ahimsa, non-violence. Okay. So the five niyamas are shosh, which is taking care of yourself. Santosh, which is acceptance that leads to the equanimity and peace. It's a radical acceptance of what is. Tapas, which means courage and bravery. Tapas, if you do yoga, you would also know that that means heat, which is the power to transform, building an inner fire within yourself, transforming figuratively and literally. Then there's... Swatdye, I'm not sure if I'm saying that one right, or I might have even written that wrong down. Which is self-knowledge and investigative study. So if you
like
started
introspection
of yourself, and then probably like some readings and books and learning from spiritual teachers and advisors and things like that. And then the last one is surrender to the divine and to the highest self and to your true self.
That's great. It's really beautiful.
And I think that's a lot of...
There's a lot of common themes here from all of the things, like the episodes you guys have done and what everybody seems to come to it eventually, right?
Yeah. Right. So we could also, just to kind of wrap up, these themes are very present in the seven sacred teachings of First Nations people.
Wow.
So those are based on the teachings of love, respect, courage, honesty, wisdom, humility, and truth. So one thing that we can tell the people, and one thing I think is really great to be telling children, especially as they start getting into an area of like peer pressure and wondering like, who am I? Be like trying to find that identity. It's that you think back on your seven sacred teachings. And if somebody's asking you to behave in a way or to do something or act in a way that goes against those teachings, then you know that it's wrong. And so it's like an inner compass to just stop yourself before, and then giving them the giving the tools of the mindfulness and the forgiveness of one's own self, because mistakes will always happen. It doesn't matter how early you get mindfulness training and whatever. We are humans. Mm. People are flawed. Things happen. You make mistakes. Life is hard.
For a lot of us, we have to go through it to learn.
We have to. Yeah. We have to.
Well, everybody has to go through it to learn. And I just actually want to mention a quick thing when you talk about the First Nations people. A couple of years ago, there was an event in Ottawa taking place about reconciliation. And I remember one of the elders spoke, and I will never forget this. She tried to speak and her English wasn't that great. And she apologized. She said, "Sometimes I'm going to say the wrong thing because I get confused between he and she, because in the way we do things, everybody is genderless."
Yeah.
How interesting is that? That because there's a correlation between how, you know, the very early Canadians treated the First Nations people and how the UK convicts or whatever treated the Indigenous Australians. Mm-hmm. They stole their children. They said, "You don't know how to look after your children." They treated them very badly. Mm-hmm. But look at some of the principles that these people had, and look at life today.
Yeah.
Look at all the shit going on about gender. We won't even go into that, but just like note that these people know what's up.
Yeah, absolutely. And that being, you know, oneness with the world and the earth and everything.
We are all humans.
And you know, yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, why don't we just let that sit in for a little while? We'll stop there and we'll just let everybody know where they can find you, Alice, and ourselves. So let's start with you, Kim. Where can listeners find you online?
So my podcast is called The Badassery Show. We have a YouTube channel. We are on iTunes. We are also on, we're hosted by Podbean. So we have a Podbean website. I think it might be thebadasseryshow.podbean.com. We're on, you know, Instagram, Facebook with all the same name. And myself and my co-host are reachable through all of those channels.
Awesome. You can find Alice online on Instagram at AliceCarbTench. This will all be in the show notes. And you can find her online, AliceCarboni.com. And you can see what she's doing to heal through cooking. Mm-hmm. Where do we find us, Lynx?
You can find us on Facebook and on
Instagram
at
and
Twitter. Muses and Stuff podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and on Twitter at Shanti and Lynx.
Awesome. And actually, before I remember this one thing that you guys are probably going to want to do, we did this thing. So we did a Skype call with this amazing woman named Lucretia, who's out in LA. She is a zine creator. She's a blogger and she loves...
Wow, she's a whole lot of woman.
She's a whole lot of woman. And she's a groupie in her own right. And she said that she does something called bibliometry? Bibliomancy?
I feel like bibliometry, but I'm not sure.
And so what it is you open whatever book it is that you're reading and you put your hand down and you read whatever it is, and then it gives you a message. It gives you a special message. I've also heard of people doing it where they read either the sentence, and then they read it in one level, and then they read it again, and then they dissect it into a second and third and fourth level. But we just did it. So I did it before.
And what was yours? Do you remember?
Yep. I opened the book, I put my finger down, and it was cigarettes and vodka did not work. That is true.
It's self-explanatory.
That is true. So I am not drinking vodka. And truthfully, I have smoked cigarettes. And
we may have done it yesterday.
No, we didn't. Oh my God, guys, we did not. I have not smoked a cigarette.
But
did
you other things?
Oh, you did.
We smoked other things yesterday.
Other things.
Okay, but it does not say cigarettes and vodka and grass.
We lit something and
cigarettes
smoked it
and
yesterday.
Vodka did not work.
No, you're right.
No tobacco was involved.
That's right.
There was no tobacco harmed in yesterday's experience.
That's right. So that's what I got. And so the girls decided that they're going to do it right now.
Live action bibliometry.
It's a very interesting book to be doing this with.
Yes. Shit. This is going to go haywire, maybe.
Yes.
Lynx, you can go.
All right. So I put my finger down on anything?
No, you have to do it. You have to read it.
Okay. He looked lost in the hotel room, and his discomfort helped make Kay fit into the scene. She was the one who was supposed to feel lost, having just arrived, young, under the gun, and in an environment that was not naturally hers.
You can unpack that one.
Oh, yes.
Okay, your turn, Kim.
That was a pretty pivotal part. Yeah. So that's when she's just arrived in LA. That's good. Okay. I'm on the chapter called Bill.
Ooh.
This one doesn't seem to have a... this must be like a subchapter because there's no song on it. And for some reason, I'm drawn to the top. Just 2 days from the self-confidence of the ocean night, on the Sunday morning that followed, Kay's only thought was killing herself. She wanted to cut up the body she hated so much. She could not bear waking up sad anymore. Actually, I'm glad we came to that because she also obviously had self-mutilation going on. She had everything, like she just had such an angst against herself. And there's a lot of talk about not being alive and wanting to be dead. And it's just, I've never had any self-mutilation issues in my life, but I know a lot of people do. So that's another thing people might be able to connect with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, amazing. Thank you so much for coming to Toronto this weekend. And I really encourage everybody to check out the Badassery podcast because I'm certainly learning a lot of things that I did not know before.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so nice to meet you both in the flesh. And I love your show too. Love Thank it right you. Back at you.
Great. This has been a great episode and a great chat. Thank you.
And thank you, Alice, for being so amazing. And thank you for having this wonderful book. And we can't wait for more.
Thank you, listeners.
Okay. Take care, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come, time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's Hypothetical.